The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
There are no norms governing human behavior, but on the other hand, says Sartre and some of the other existentialists, we must distinguish between authentic existence and inauthentic existence. Without going into that in detail, I hope you can see that there's a problem there of saying that on the one hand there's no norm, there's no standard, there's no criterion by which you can judge the quality of a human life, and then on the other hand saying, but I will judge the quality of human life on the basis of what is of my concept of authentic existence. Either authentic existence is a norm or it isn't. If it is a norm, then of course we can't deny that there are norms. If it's not a norm, then it's very perplexing as to what the concept of authentic existence is. And then five, of course, which I briefly alluded to, the principle that existence precedes essence is basically the idea that human beings have no nature, being uncreated, and you can't say what a human being is until after that human being has existed. Marxism, again going out of chronological order, but picking up Marxism in the 20th century because that's where it seems to have had the largest impact. Marxism, which of course has influenced liberation theology very strongly, represents a kind of upside-down Hegelianism. Whether Marx turned Hegel on his head or whether Marx turned Hegel right side up, there seems to be some discussion of that. But anyway, there is that kind of inverted, that kind of paradoxical relationship between Marx and Hegel. In both cases, you have dialectic, you have dialectical method, the idea that history sort of proceeds through conflict, and the thinking proceeds through negation. Remember, Hegel said that your thinking proceeds when you can see difficulties in this idea, that leads you on to this idea, see difficulties in that, that leads you on to this. Hegel also believed that that's the way world history works. You have this state of affairs, then that degenerates into conflict, creating a new state of affairs, conflict there, new state of affairs, and so on. And the process of thought and the process of world history are parallel to one another, see rationalism, and not only are they parallel to one another, but ultimately they are the same thing. Now, Marx has a similar kind of view about world history. Marx, too, believes that history proceeds by way of conflict and resolution of those conflicts at different stages. He's not all that excited about Hegel's ideas concerning thought. For him, well, I'll get to that in a moment. Anyway, history does proceed according to conflict, and you're aware, of course, of how he conceived of that conflict. It's essentially a socioeconomic conflict between those who own the means of production and those who serve them as laborers within the process of production. And essentially, it's those production relationships, those relationships of economic, within the realm of economics, that propel history, that move history along from one state of affairs to another. Now, so far as knowledge is concerned, Marx is interesting because he's sensitive to the influence of socioeconomic factors on knowledge, and this is something that's really come into its own in the last 20 years, possibly due to the influence of Marx in our own time. But Marx, long before the so-called sociology of knowledge became developed, Marx was saying things very similar to what people have said in our own time. Essentially, Marx maintained that your views of the world are very heavily influenced. Indeed, this is the greatest influence on them. They are very heavily influenced by your social economic position. If you're rich, you think like a rich person. If you're poor, you think like a poor person. If you're bourgeois, you think like a bourgeois. If you're proletarian, you think like a proletarian. And these are different ways of thinking. These are different sets of values, similar to Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard said that you have different styles of life and different and your thinking is going to be different depending on what your style of life is. If you're an aesthete, you'll think in one way. If you're a moralist, you'll think in another way. If you're a Christian, you'll think in another way. And so Marx turns this around into an economic argument and sees that economically. And it has a lot of tie-ins with Feuerbach and Freud. We won't be able to explore those, but perhaps some of you might like to do so in your research. He argues that there are no norms for right thinking that are universally applicable. That is to say, there is no absolute authority which everybody must bow before and presuppose in his thinking. Rather, there are different norms depending on the social economic class that you belong to. Those who are bourgeois will follow one set of norms. Those who are proletarians will follow a different set of norms, and so on and so forth. You can see how that really amounts to irrationalism as we've been defining it. That is to say, there is no objective truth. There is no truth that's truth for everybody. There's truth only for a particular class. And therefore, he seems to be abandoning the goal of objective truth. On the other hand, there are all kinds of claims in Marx to be scientific. And when Marx is arguing the scientific character of his system, one inevitably thinks that he believes, at least, that he's got hold of some kind of objective truth, something that he can use to persuade others that his view is the correct view. And indeed, those claims have been made by many Marxists since that time. So again, you have rationalism and irrationalism working together. Marx thinks that he can break down religious views, Hegelian views, Kierkegaardian views, whatever, on the basis of his scientific arguments for which he claims objectivity. But then on the other hand, he has a kind of epistemology that rules out that objectivity, and you see the contradiction there. I think that's helpful, you know, when kids go away to school. Somebody has said recently that there are probably more communists on the faculty of Harvard than there are in the Soviet Union anymore, but with communism on the decline, you still have a lot of Marxists in Western universities. I trust that that will decline too eventually, but who knows? But, you know, your kids go away to a secular college and they're confronted with Marxism, and a lot of it, I think the typical kid who gets excited about Marxism is excited about it because he sees that these people really want to do something about the poor, really want to do something about the difficult economic situations that people find themselves in, and they're impressed with the compassion of teachers and so on and so forth. So it's the values the Marxist teachers have that seem to be the most impressive thing about Marxism, really the most the thing that seems to recommend it most highly. But then when you get into the epistemology and you start to understand the philosophy of Marxism a bit, you see that they really don't have any basis for asserting values at all. In fact, they've renounced the idea of any kind of values that bind all human minds. So There, I think we see the conflict of rationalism and irrationalism. Process philosophy associated with Whitehead and his disciples, of course, Hartshorne, Cobb, Griffin, Ogden, any number of others, begin, and this is, of course, very, very popular today in the theological institutions, very much suspicious of abstractions like, I won't go into that too much more. Essentially, process philosophy is Heraclitean. Remember, Heraclitus was the one who believed that everything is constantly changing. The world is in motion, the world is in process. Heraclitus said you cannot step in the same river twice, because when you step in the river the second time, it's not the same river. The water has passed by. So there's a constant change. And remember, Heraclitus had a problem as to what to do with that. How can you describe the world if the world is constantly changing? How do you analyze, how do you conceptualize the world if the world is constantly changing? And he came up with the concept of the logos, which is the idea of a kind of constant pattern in which the world is moving. The process philosophers also need to find some point of stability within this constant process. So they argue a number of kind of metaphysical realities. The world is made up of tiny actual occasions. That's a variety of atomism. These are the smallest constituents of reality, you might say. And nevertheless, they're patterned after human beings, at least as they're described. Each of these actual occasions, each of these atoms is partly determined by its past, but not wholly determined by its past. It's also able to make free choices that are not caused at all by the past history of the occasion. These are engaged, therefore, in constant change. Each one is born, and they're immediately after an occasion is born, it's forced to make some kind of change. Not forced to, but its nature is to make some kind of change. And that kind of, that change is brought about by something like a free choice. Each of them make their choices by the fact that they have access to past occasions. They can go back to history, in other words, and benefit from history in making their choices, just sort of like we do. Or they can consider various ideals, again, sort of like we do. We can try to be more like the ideal person and so on. The ideals are like Platonic forms. Process philosophers call them eternal objects. And these eternal objects serve as the stable point in the philosophy. I say that everything changes. However, these eternal objects do not change. This is the one exception that's made. The eternal objects do not change. And so this is supposed to provide the point of stability that's needed in a basically Heraclitean philosophy. The problem, however, with the eternal objects is that these are unlike Plato's in one significant way. Plato believed that the eternal objects really do exist. He believed that there really was such a thing as a tree in general. He really did believe that there was such a thing as an ideal triangle or an ideal man. In process philosophy, the eternal objects are not real things. The eternal objects are possible things, possibilities. And they become actual only when one of these actual occasions decides to adopt that particular possibility and translate that possibility into actuality. Again, the model is human life. I may choose to become more like an ideal man. And when I do that, well, of course, I become more like an ideal man. So this possibility becomes in some degree more actual. Or I decide that I want to be a carpenter, so I study to become a carpenter. Well, a carpenter is a possible lifestyle. It's a possible way of living. And the more I become a carpenter, of course, the more that possibility becomes actual. But it becomes actual only insofar as I make my own free choice to make it actual. So the eternal objects are not actualities in themselves, they're only possibilities. Now the process philosophers also believe in a kind of God. God contains the world and yet somehow transcends it. The process philosophers claim that they're not pantheists, where they simply say that the world is God and God is the world. Spinoza would be a pantheist in that sense. Hegel would be a pantheist in that sense. But the process philosophers say no. The world is included in God, but God transcends the world in some way. The name, of course, that they use to describe that position is the term panentheism. Panentheism, that means everything is in God rather than everything is God. But, of course, the result is the same in the sense that the Christian creator-creature distinction is lost. Certainly in process philosophy, it's very much the case that you are part of God, I am a part of God. They do have parts in God. The trees and the tables and the doggies and the kitties are all part of God. So that you don't have the kind of creator-creature distinction that Reformed theology and Scripture emphasize. What we have here, again, I think is autonomous thought, rationalism, and there are very strong claims in process philosophy that thought must be autonomous, that it must not be subjected to some kind of external authority. Autonomous thought, rationalism, trying very hard to find a stable meaning in the midst of constant change. But do they succeed in doing that? Do they succeed in finding stability in the midst of constant change? They try to do that through the doctrine of the eternal object. Do they succeed in that? I think not, because the eternal object is not a reality. The eternal object is not an actuality. It's not really a part of the world. The eternal object is only a possibility which can be made actual, but when it's made actual, it becomes just as subject to change as everything else is. So the world is essentially Heraclitean, and there's not even a there's no plausible way of slowing it down or taking some kind of snapshot of the world that remains stable long enough to even begin the work of philosophy and seeking to know the world. Then we get into That's strange, you know. I've always wondered why process philosophy has so much holding power. You know, Whitehead wrote his book in about 1919, something like that. Samuel Alexander before him. But anyway, I don't think it's that great a philosophy. I don't think it's that interesting, really, but it seems to have continued. It seems to have this momentum. Hartshorne picked it up in the 40s, 30s and 40s, and then it became the rage in theology around the 50s and 60s, and for some reason I think maybe in liberal circles it's starting to tail off a little bit finally, but then you have these, as you mentioned, evangelicals like Pinnock arguing that God doesn't know the future and so on and so forth. I think that in that case, and this would be the case with Richard Rice also, I think it's partly the logic of Arminian theology working itself out. Arminian theology has always had this trouble with the concept of foreknowledge. On the one hand, it bases divine sovereignty on foreknowledge. At least historically, divine foreknowledge has been very important to Arminian theology because it's the only way that they can really do justice to, in their minds, to divine sovereignty. God controls the world by knowing it beforehand and being therefore able to take everything into account. But now, there's always been this problem in Arminianism that if God foreknow, if election is based on foreknowledge, if election is based on the fact that God knows before the foundation of the world that Joe will believe, let's say, and then God knowing that this is going to happen, that Joe's going to believe of his free will, then God predestines him to blessing and glory. With that concept of predestination, you see, which depends so much on the concept of foreknowledge, you have to ask, what's the basis for this foreknowledge? If God knows before the foundation of the world that Joe is going to believe, how does he know that? Does he know that because he predetermines it? No, that's impossible on an Arminian basis. God doesn't predetermine our free decisions. So on what basis does he know it? Does he know it because of something else? Something apart from God that guarantees that Joe will believe? You see, that really gets you into trouble. Then you really have some kind of dualism or some other kind of eternal being over against God that does predetermine people to believe and so on and so forth. So what Pinnock is doing is sort of cutting the Gordian knot, and he's saying, okay, God doesn't predetermine people to believe, and he doesn't even know who's going to believe and who isn't going to believe. That is purely a matter of free choice, and it's not predetermined by God, it's not predetermined by some other being, it's not predetermined by anything, and therefore God doesn't know. The future is essentially indefinite. And it just happened that as this problem was developing, and of course it's much older than the 20th century, the problem has existed, for many centuries, ever since, Pelagius and others have been trying to think in these terms. But now we've got process philosophy with us, and Rice and Pinnock are smart enough to, read some of these process philosophers and see that, you can develop a kind of concept of God without the idea of foreknowledge. And so they've jumped on that. Now, it just seems so ridiculous to me, because it's just so obviously unscriptural. I mean, the God of the Bible most clearly does know the future, and he predicts the future, and that's the criterion for a true prophet, somebody who. So I don't know how you can make that credible biblically, but the logic of Arminianism is a very strong incentive to that kind of view, and you put that together with some of the premises of process philosophy, and to some people, that's a very strong argument.
In Calvin.
Uh-huh. Well, okay, you guys. You take that as a challenge, Start writing. Start showing them that that's not the case. Take that, the other guy's coach is saying that about your team, and, get going and win some games here for Calvin. Okay. Logical atomism. Here we're getting into what's sometimes called analytic philosophy, that is, philosophy which proceeds by way of the analysis of language, tries to solve philosophical problems by analyzing language. There are many forms of this, and I'm only going to discuss a few of the historically important forms of it, some of the earlier forms. First called logical atomism, Bertrand Russell earlier in the century wrote with, interestingly, he co-authored a book with Alfred North Whitehead called Principia Mathematica, in which he developed a very sophisticated system of logic, made some remarkable advances in the science of logic, and he was quite impressed with the work that he had done, and he wrote an article. He published the book in 1911, and then he wrote an article in 1914 called Logical Atomism, in which he suggested that maybe this new logic of his could be turned into a philosophy, a whole new way of looking at the world. Russell's remarkable pupil, Ludwig Wittgenstein, came along and wrote a book called the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, sort of a takeoff on Spinoza's Tractatus Theologico-Politicus. Tractatus just means treatise, logical-philosophical treatise. And Wittgenstein tried to carry out Russell's program in that book, taking the logic of the Principia Mathematica and using that logic to purify language, to develop a pure language. A language, and I could go into detail about it, but let me just say, top of page 8, that what they hoped was that this pure language would be a perfect picture of the world, a perfect picture of the world. Here you have the world as they understood it, the world made up of facts. Fact 1, fact 2, fact 3, fact 4. And they were hoping to develop a language which would consist of sentences in which every sentence would correspond perfectly with one of those facts. So here's language, here's the perfect language, S1, sentence 1, sentence 2, sentence 3, sentence 4. And each one of those sentences then states a fact. Sentence 1 states fact 1, sentence 2 states fact 2. For however many facts there are in the universe. If there are 70 billion facts, then there would be 70 billion sentences in the language that could express that. You can see how they might have thought that this language then would turn into a, would be a kind of picture of the world. They dealt, worked this out more in detail. They analyzed facts into various elements. In every fact, there's a thing and possibly a property, possibly one or more relationships. And so facts consist of things, properties, and relations, and sentences consist in words. So in the perfect language, you would have each word in each sentence would correspond with one element of the fact. You'd have one word representing a thing, another word representing a property, another word representing a relation. And so again, you can see how the language would be seen as a kind of picture of the world. Now, Wittgenstein discovered, however, that, and this is in the same book, incidentally, it's rare that you find a philosophy book that's so much aware of its own limitations that produces, really, in the same, this book produced its own refutation. It included its own refutation. Wittgenstein says if you start off by purifying language, supposedly you'd get a perfect picture of the world and you'd really know the world. But Wittgenstein discovered that that much of what we want to say, even in philosophy, could not be said in the perfect language. Now, the perfect language was conceived of kind of in an empiricist way. The perfect language, how do you identify a fact? It's basically through the senses, through scientific methods, and so on and so forth. But he discovered that using those kinds of methods to develop his facts, you couldn't talk about values, for example. You couldn't talk about ethics because you can't get ethical knowledge through empirical means. You can't talk about necessity, because as Hume pointed out, sense experience doesn't yield any data about necessity. And you can't really talk about you can't talk about God, because God, of course, he says, is not revealed through sense experience. So there are all kinds of things that are sort of ruled out of the perfect language. These are things that can't be said. And if they aren't sayable in the perfect language, then of course they're not, they don't exist in the real world either. But Wittgenstein wasn't quite pleased with that. He was a man of considerable ethical sensitivity, for example, and he thought that there must be more to ethics than just a kind of meaningless value talk that really doesn't have anything to do with the real world. So Wittgenstein assigned a kind of sphere for some of these things that can't be said in the perfect language, and therefore we can't say that they exist, but we feel there must be something to them. And that realm was called the mystical realm. And in the mystical realm, he included ethical values, good and right and so on. He included God. He included necessity. And another thing that was interesting that he included in there, also the world as an organized totality. This begins to look a lot like Kant's noumenal sphere, because just about everything that Kant put in the noumenal, Wittgenstein put in the mystical. The world is a totality, the self, the noumenal self, you might say, what we really are, which of course doesn't appear to the senses either. And another kind of interesting thing that Wittgenstein relegated to the mystical was the relationship between language and reality, okay? Relationship between language and the world. And you might say, well, now wait a minute here. I mean, the whole book is supposed to present the relation between language and the world. Isn't that what the whole philosophy is about, that we have a perfect language that perfectly reflects the world? How can you now take all of that and put it into the mystical? And Wittgenstein's argument essentially is this. When you here I am, I'm looking at the world, I'm looking at all these facts. I see tables and chairs, I see trees, I see people, I see clocks, and so on and so forth. I can see language too, in some measure, but I don't see the relationship between language in general and the world in general, okay? I don't see that relationship. I can see people using words to designate things. I can see that kind of thing going on. I can see, I can hear that. I can hear myself doing that. But when I try to express that in language, that creates another relation. See, I describe that relation. That would be this one here. But in doing that, I create another relation, namely relationship between this sentence and this fact. And this, in general, can't be described. You can't describe the relation. You can only describe facts. Perfect language only includes facts. It doesn't include these relations, the relation between the sentences and the fact. So Wittgenstein came to the end of the book and said that essentially everything that he had tried to say was meaningless under its own criteria. The basic things that he's trying to say are meaningless on his own standards of meaning, and therefore they all go up here into the mystical sphere. Well, if that's true, of course, then he's refuted his own argument, and you really can't get a perfect language such that it will give you a perfect view, a perfect picture of the world. Then, of course, the logical positivists came along. Yes. Well, it's mystical in that it can't be described. It can't be spoken of. I think that's the main thing. The main contrast in this book is between what is sayable and what is not. And what is sayable is meaningful. These facts, you know, they are sayable because there's a sentence in the perfect language which corresponds to them. Yeah, and that he knows that, okay? So he tries various things. He tries to describe ethical values in the perfect language, says it won't work, okay? Tries to describe God, no, that won't work. So all of these get relegated to the mystical sphere. The mystical sphere is the sphere of those things which cannot be spoken of, which cannot be truly spoken of. For him, because he's constantly discovering things that go in there, it's not growing on its own because the things that are in there will always be in there, presumably. No, he would say that in principle these things can't be spoken of. Yeah, you'll never find something that's really an ethical value can be formulated in the perfect language. He wrote an essay on ethics that's very interesting, where he said that if anybody could write a book on ethics, which really was a book on ethics, it would destroy all the other books in the world. Now, I think John Warwick Montgomery at one time took that to be the Bible. He said that Wittgenstein was sort of longing for an authoritative ethic that would overshadow all the other ones. I don't think that's what Wittgenstein meant at all. I think what he meant was that that's so impossible, such an impossible supposition, that if that's the case, then the world is not rational at all. I mean, if there could actually be a book of ethics, then there's no rationality in the world at all. Logical positivism advanced the so-called verification principle that no statement is informatively meaningful. There's always some kind of qualification on that word, meaningful, cognitively meaningful, or informatively meaningful, I have here. Unless it can be verified by some quasi-scientific process. Really, that was implicit also in Wittgenstein's Tractatus, as I indicated to you. Even in the Tractatus, you have this idea that to be in the perfect language, you have to get it through the senses. And the positivists are trying to purify the Tractatus. They're very impressed with the Tractatus, but they don't like the self-refuting aspect of it, obviously. They're trying to get rid of that. They're trying to get rid of the mystical realm and all of that stuff. So they start off with the premise that no statement is informatively meaningful unless it can be verified by some quasi-scientific process. Therefore, metaphysics, ethics, religion are excluded, as in logical atomism. So again, you can't speak meaningfully of ethical values. You can't speak meaningfully of God. They had to backtrack a little bit on ethical values. I'll explain that later. But generally speaking, they wanted to eliminate these what they considered superstitious uses of language, and say that these are not really meaningful. They don't really express facts. Doug?
Just to step back for a second.
Russell just kind of moved from one position to another throughout his life. He developed most of the time, Russell held to a variety of realism or empiricism. There was this little period in the teens of the century where he kind of thought that his Principia Mathematica might result in a whole new approach and so on and so forth. But Russell didn't stick with anything for too long. He lived a very long time and went through a lot of different phases, and most of the time he was a fairly traditional empiricist, or seemed to be somewhat under the influence of Scottish realism too at times. He was an idealist very early in his life, and he talks about how he walked out of a tobacco store once, and he was smoking a pipe, and all of a sudden he was startled, and the pipe fell out of his mouth, and the tobacco flew everywhere, and he said, "By Jove, the ontological argument is sound." But didn't stay with that very long. Didn't agree with that. So the logical positivists are trying to pick up the pieces from logical atomism, sort of. And they are trying to do the same thing, in a way, trying to get rid of all these so-called superstitious uses of language so that language could be used for its proper purpose, which in their view is scientific speech. It's looking, in retrospect, it's a little naive that they didn't, that they considered only, they really didn't consider all the wide variety of uses of language other than scientific speech, but they never succeeded in formulating the verification principle in a way that satisfied all of them. They were essentially trying to come up with a concept of verification which would exclude all of these so-called superstitious uses of language, but would include all of the range of scientific language that they wanted to include. It turned out that was a very difficult thing to do, and you can read the history of this in books like Urmson's Philosophical Analysis, or I know Alvin Plantinga has a discussion of this someplace where they tried one thing and it included too much. It let the superstitious language in, and then they tried something else and that ruled out the scientific language, and then they tried something else and so on and so forth. And finally they gave it up because it just became an obvious example of conceptual gerrymandering, you know, trying to come up with a concept which precisely excluded this and included that, rather than trying to, you know, say what we really mean by meaning, if indeed that concept can be analyzed at all. And then eventually it was discovered that the verification principle itself was not verifiable, and that was the end of that. The next phase was we might call ordinary language philosophy. This is connected with the later work of Wittgenstein. After Wittgenstein published his Tractatus, he left philosophy and worked at various odd jobs during the 1920s. He designed a house for his sister to live in. He worked as a caretaker in a monastery. He thought of becoming a monk at one time. He was a teacher in an elementary school. He all kinds of things, but not philosophy. And there are a lot of interesting discussions about why he left philosophy and why he came back later. He did come back later in 1929, and in the first 4 years or so that he taught at Cambridge, he followed pretty much the Tractatus and the older way of thinking that he had developed, but around 33, 34, 35, he began to reason in a rather different kind of way from the way he had reasoned before, and people began to speak of the later Wittgenstein. Probably the slogan that we associate most with the later Wittgenstein is the slogan that meaning is use. Wittgenstein said in a very large class of cases where we use the term meaning, not all, and he's careful to say there's some exceptions to this, but in most cases where we use the word meaning, we can say the meaning of a word is its use in the language. The meaning of an expression is its use in the language. The old Tractatus idea was trying to establish a concept of meaning. Here you have the facts of the world. Here you have the sentences of the language. Every sentence refers to a fact. And that reference, that referring relation, is what's called meaning here. The logical positivists also had their concept of meaning. For them, meaning was verification. And the way you show the meaning of a sentence is to show how that sentence can be verified. And once you show how it can be verified, then you know what the meaning of it is. That's kind of like the pragmatist approach of Charles Peirce, that you show what your ideas mean by showing what would have to be done in order to verify them or falsify them. In ordinary language philosophy, you've got still another concept of meaning here. Meaning is use, and if you've done much reading in DKG, you may observe the parallel. I won't say too much about it at the moment, but you may observe the parallel between the statement meaning is use and the statement theology is application. If you want to accuse me of being a Wittgensteinian, you can write papers to that effect, and we can talk about them, and that would be very interesting. I must confess that this provoked some thinking on my part, and led to a few formulations that I probably wouldn't have made if I hadn't read Wittgenstein along here, but... I think I'm working on different criteria from him. I think I have a very definite idea of what I'm applying in the Word of God. But anyway, in ordinary language philosophy, there's a spirit of greater openness now, rather than this gerrymandering kind of thing where you try with all your might and main to exclude certain kinds of language from the human vocabulary. Now there's more of an openness, kind of a glasnost or perestroika. You're admitting all these kinds of language back in, Now you're not, you don't say metaphysical language is meaningless. You don't say ethical language is meaningless. You say they're meaningful, but you because they're used. They're meaningful because they have a use. Any language that has a use is meaningful. Even theological language is meaningful because it has a use. But then, of course, you try to analyze and specify what that use is. Despite the spirit of openness, I do sense in Wittgenstein and in a lot of his followers a kind of dogmatism, a tendency to be dogmatic about what the proper uses of words must be. Wittgenstein wrote an essay about religious language where he made a very strong attempt to restrict religious language to say what it can be used for and what it can't be used for. And he insisted, of course, that it cannot be used contradict some scientific hypothesis. There can't be any cross-reference between religious language and scientific language, because religious language has one purpose, scientific language has a radically different purpose, and really when you try to bring them together, it's a cross-purpose, and you're never going to get a meaningful discussion going. You're misunderstanding the fact that religion is not intended to make assertions about science, and science is not intended to make assertions about language. So you avoid the science-religion controversy by compartmentalizing religious language, compartmentalizing scientific language, so that there can be no conflict between them, and indeed no agreement between them. They're just representing different... they're in two completely different universes of discourse. On the other hand, there's the glasnost side ordinary language philosophy, a tendency to allow almost any language that people actually use and to be uncritical. And I guess my problem with all of this is that I don't see any pattern, any clear... way of discerning how liberal we should be. You know, on the one hand, sometimes these people seem to be saying, well, almost anything is permitted. And sometimes they seem to be saying, no, we'll tell you what's permitted and what's not. And we've got very strong ideas as to what language is permitted and what's not. And I don't see the principle that enables them to say just what fits under the glasnost side and what fits under the dogmatic exclusion. Now that brings us up almost to the present day. I have that paper that I gave you on contemporary epistemology. It's actually an account of John Pollock's book, which is called Contemporary Theories of Knowledge, and I want you to read that for Friday. We'll get into that when we talk about justification of knowledge, and that's dealing with essentially with developments in epistemology from 1960 down to the present. That will bring you, I think, somewhat up to date on the secular developments in the history of epistemology, and we can discuss some of those things when we get to that point. To summarize this whole discussion, let me just point out some things, some patterns which seem to have emerged. First, that the rationalist-irrationalist dialectic seems to be inseparable from the assumption that knowledge is autonomous. Once you adopt that assumption, that knowledge is autonomous, that I am my own criterion in the area of knowledge, then of course you already have rationalism in the broad sense that we've defined it. That is what rationalism is. But then when you try to make that work, and you try to use that autonomous approach to develop an exhaustive knowledge of the world, it breaks down somewhere. You find it just won't do the job. And where that happens, of course, you run into irrationalism. You, because your principle has failed, and yet you hang on to that principle anyway. So there's a kind of general reason, then, why any philosophy, apart from the specifics of Hegel and Kant and Hume and so on, there seems to be this general reason why any philosophy which begins with human autonomy is going to run into this rationalist-irrationalist dialectic that Dr. Van Til describes. But top of nine, we can learn some positive things from these thinkers. Certainly they have legitimate concerns. Certainly when Plato developed his theory of forms, he was responding to a genuine need in epistemology. There is a genuine need to find a criteria, to find standards. And that's what Plato was looking for in his theory of forms, and that's what he thought that he found, however successful or unsuccessful he was in putting that together in a theory of knowledge. And certainly, you know, you can go down through the list, reason, sense, language, presuppositions, values, criteria. All of these do play roles in knowledge. And of course, I guess I left off of the list all of Kierkegaard's concerns about the knowing subject and about the fact that the person must be equipped in various ways to get the knowledge that he has. All of that is certainly an important element too. So I would say that it's wrong to exclude any of these from a theory of knowledge, and it's also wrong to take any of these elements as absolute and deify them. That's, of course, the other tendency. You say, well, we need criteria, and so you absolutize the concept of a criterion. You deify it, as Plato did, and then you try to construct your theory of knowledge that way. No, but we do need to have a theory of knowledge that makes room for all these different elements, and perhaps to some extent there may be value in thinking of them as perspectives. Well, let's take another break. Let's try to make it fairly brief, and then I'll go through this third section here on more personal influences. This is